Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I'm your host, Ken Molman, and this is the My View Matters Radio Network. Oh, man, I am now soaked from head to toe about 3 minutes before the show. It decided to have a torrential downpour here, and I have my windows down in my car, so had to go wind the windows up, and I'm soaked from head to toe, which is wonderful. Prior to that, my printer was acting crazy, so I had a interesting time getting everything ready for the show today, but I did get it ready to go. Just one of those days, I guess. But anyway, folks, I forgot to open the chat room up, so I should do that real fast here. So if you want to get in the chat room, that's opening up now. And I do look at the chat room during the breaks. Tonight we've got a lot. It's been piling up for a couple of weeks here, and there's a lot to go over. So we're going to do another two-hour show probably tonight, depending on, you know, how it goes and the calls and whatnot. And speaking of calls, if you'd like to call in about anything we're going to talk about tonight, the number here is 858-683-1326. Again, area code 858-683-1326. So I guess to start, just got something kind of light and silly here. There's a study that came out that shows correlation, not causation, but correlation between a vegetarian diet and mental disorders. And, of course, it doesn't really say whether the mental disorders are caused by the vegetarian diet or the vegetarian diet's caused by the mental disorders. And certainly it's not everyone who's a vegetarian and whatever. But it is an interesting study that their conclusion is that a vegetarian diet is associated with an elevated risk of mental disorders. However, there's no evidence for the causal role of vegetarian diet in the etiology of mental disorders. So, anyway, I just thought that was kind of interesting, and that's why I grabbed that. Here in Kentucky, we've got a handful of issues, as I'm sure everyone's aware. Let's see, there was some bad news that came out from Bloomberg on LaGrange, which is in Oldham County, and LaGrange's credit rating has been dropped to junk and basically on the verge of default, and essentially it's due to some poor planning, some overbuilding, some what they really attribute most of it to is a large industrial park that they tried to build in LaGrange, where they did build it, but it only has one tenant. And as a result, it's not paying for itself, and they're having trouble paying for their bills. So certainly not the only city in the Commonwealth that's having issues right now. We've got a number of cities that have pension problems and budget problems. And, of course, we've been in this recession now for, 6 years or so, and you know, with any prolonged recession, that's going to have a hit on all kinds of things, not only our individual wallets, but also because there's less activity, less economic activity, and less money to go around, our local governments also take a hit. Now, part of this is because the local governments decide that they're going to create these master plans and, you know, invest, and they always use numbers that kind of require that things remain as they are or better. And certainly there's a case to be made that a lot of these issues are self-inflicted, that were they more careful with how and what they invested in and you know, try to stay out of more things and let the free market handle things and really focus on core essential services, that you wouldn't end up in these scenarios. You know, certainly, you know, the cities like LaGrange that have overbuilt, they're not alone. I mean, here in Pendleton County, we've got an industrial park, and it's not doing so great. And I really think these industrial parks and technology centers and all these things that get built are using the flawed model of build it and they will come. And I think that that's one of the big issues. You know, additionally, a lot of this stuff, there's a lot of talk about special tax incentives for certain size companies to move into the state from other places. And I have a problem with those because, you know, the special tax incentives, essentially what they're doing is we're subsidizing, we're giving, if anything, we're giving an unfair advantage to one competitor over another. And in that specific scenario, we're giving a advantage, we're giving an advantage to the people who are just moving in and putting the people who have been in the community for however long, whether it's 1 year or 50 years in the community, at a disadvantage competitively. And I think that that's something that we really need to reconsider. And I know that it's my understanding anyway that David Adams has filed a lawsuit in that regard, saying that the state has no authority to do these special taxing incentive deals. And there's a number of items and whatnot, and I haven't read that case yet, but the goal of any tax policy should be that all businesses benefit, all individuals benefit, and that people come here because they want to come here because the tax environment is good. When you create special incentives, a good friend of mine calls these companies that move in on those incentives piranha or predator companies. And the idea behind it is many of them will move in for the tax incentive period, and when the tax incentive is over, they just move back out. They move somewhere else, wherever the incentive is this time. And we saw that up here in northern Kentucky where companies like Omnicare and the Nielsen Company were in Covington and had come here because of special tax incentives. And because the city of Cincinnati and the state of Ohio created incentives that were better, they then moved out and went back over to Ohio. So, in fact, the governor of Ohio basically said he was going to make it his job to steal all of our businesses from northern Kentucky, which, of course, doesn't do too good for relations between northern Kentucky and Cincinnati. But the point is, we've got to do a better job of focusing. Excuse me, I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me. Folks, I apologize. Usually I get everything all ready to go before the show, and I literally was running around to the last minute here. So I'm getting my drink of water and all this stuff while I'm doing the intro here. But I guess the point is that we have all these communities that have overspent, overcommitted, and there comes a point where it needs to be reexamined. Is the path we're on the right path, or do we just need to cut our losses and bail out of some of these programs? You know, there was a up here in Campbell County, the fiscal court built a $14 million building for the county government. And it's a long story, and there's a lot of complex other things behind the story, but the core of it is we really didn't need that $14 million building, and that building is way too expensive for what it is. There was talk of trying to get the county to sell that building, and what ended up coming of it was that the county themselves admitted that if they sold the building, they'd take a loss because they could never sell it for what they had in it. Well, that seems like that's a pretty poor investment, if you ask me, to build a building where you end up from day one underwater on the building. And I don't really know how to explain or I don't understand how this can be justified to build something or to build anything, a building, whatever, and day one it's upside down and underwater and an investment we're going to lose money on. I don't understand who thought that was a good idea. Now, I see a caller in the queue here, and I'm going to bring them on. And Blog Talk's acting funny, so I hope that they want to come on. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Ken. How you doing? It's Randolph Vance.
Hey, Randolph. How you doing, my friend?
I'm all right. Just got back from the fair. I'll talk about that in a minute. But what you're saying about the about governments, local governments in particular, that they're building unnecessary buildings, they're making huge expansions to their own power. And it comes from, I think a lot of it comes from the kickbacks that they get from contracting groups. I know in Lexington, the Webb Brothers was pretty big once upon a time. There's some other developers now, thank goodness. But, you know, at one time, the Webb Brothers had pretty much all the development in Lexington locked, and you couldn't get anything built unless you had the Webb Brothers' approval or you had the Webb Brothers billing it for you. So there's quite a lot of corruption in that, where local businesses or local developers will partner with the local governments just to get what they want done, and they'll have these huge over budget contracts. Like you were bringing up that $14 million building. I guarantee you that, you know, that building could have been built for probably at least half of that.
Right,
and there's no logic behind this. What we've got abandoned buildings in strip malls. You've got abandoned buildings. You've got Turfland Mall right now in Lexington sitting pretty much empty. Why can't? All right, let's say if Lexington needed to build new offices for the urban county government, mm-hmm. they're not going to take over existing property that they could convert over into usable office space, but they would rather just tear down and bulldoze Turfland Mall and build up some gigantic 50-story monstrosity that would cost the taxpayers even more when we're already strapped as it is on our budget in terms of police pensions, in terms of city debt. And now, and on top of that, recently you heard that Rupp Arena is going to be doing a major expansion and overhaul. So,
yes.
Did you hear about that? Yeah. There's more government building. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, there's some controversy
right
surrounding that. We haven't really covered that on the show. We haven't covered it on the show, but there's some controversy about where some of that funding for Rupp's coming from. Some of that funding's coming out of the coal severance money, and Eastern Kentucky is not happy, especially those in and around Pikeville, where Pikeville has a college. They tried to put it into the state university system this past year, and they were told, hey, there's no money for that. And then they turn around and take, I think it was $2.1 or $2.3 million out of the state budget and dump it into Rupp Arena. And that has Eastern Kentucky all up in arms.
Because it was pre-earmarked. It was earmarked long before that announcement was made about the expansion for Rupp. They're like, oh, well, there's no money in the coal severance fund. And people are wondering, well, how much money is there? There's just no money. Trust us on that. And now finally the truth's coming out about it, that it's going to the Rupp expansion. So,
right. And
but,
it's unfortunate. And one of the next steps in all this is something I'm going to touch on here in a few minutes, but these public-private partnerships that they're trying to create now. And there's a push to try to expand those in Kentucky, and specifically trying to make it so that we can get different things built with public-private partnerships. Up here in northern Kentucky, they and actually down in Louisville, they want to do the bridges that way. They want the new bridges, the new interstate bridges, to be privately owned and to be tolled by those private companies. You know, my big problem with
that
is...
Yeah, who's going to collect the toll?
Is
it going to be
the
state?
Oh,
the company will.
Oh, no, the private company.
Yeah,
it's their money. They built the bridge, so they get the profit. And that's really the key for me is that, you know, with roads and basic infrastructure, there's no mechanism to ever have a true competitive market. There's one thing to be said when you can have a competitive market, and great, private. If you can have a competitive market, I'm all about the private sector. But when you have a scenario where the resource is a monopoly resource. It's not like they're going to add more bridges or allow some other company to build a bridge right next to this one. You're talking about a monopoly piece of infrastructure that is given to a private company, and they'll be allowed to toll this thing till the cows come home. And, you know, it's been shown that even in the past, when the state of Kentucky had tolls on, like, the Bluegrass Parkway and all the parkways, it took lawsuits to force the state to give up those tolls because there's things in our Constitution that require them to do so once those aren't in use anymore, or once they're paid
off. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Tolls have to.
But there's
tolls,
nothing that says
tolls have to originate. Don't they have to originate from the state transportation cabinet? And they have to be regulated in some way.
Yes and no. If it's private property, though, can it be? And that's the big question. So in the scenario we have with our parkways, where they basically tolled them for too long after they were paid off, they kept trying to toll them, and there were lawsuits that forced them all off. Those were all public roads, owned by the state. If we flip that scenario to being a private road owned by a private entity, is there any mechanism, is there any legal recourse to ever get them to stop tolling those roads? Is there any legal recourse?
Yeah. For that matter, if you're driving onto private property, they could start tolling you. It could be the Pandora's box to open up a huge nightmare where you have to pay just to get in any place. You have to pay a toll. So.
Well, in the market would normally take care of that, right? I mean, certainly there are clubs that charge cover fees at night and whatnot, and charging a fee or a toll to enter somewhere isn't necessarily unique to this situation, but it's something that usually competition keeps in check, right? If you go to a club and they're charging a $20 cover, chances are real good, Randolph, that you and I would be like, $20 to get in? I don't think so, brother. I'm out of here. I'll go find another place to go, right?
But there's only the one bridge. Yeah.
Where else are you going to go? You're going to drive 25 miles around? Oh, wait, that one's a toll bridge too. Oh, so sorry. So, I mean, the problem is that they're creating a scenario where they're going to force people to pay this toll. And on top of it, and what really I don't like more than anything is the mechanism by which they're going to use to force to pay the tolls. It's not going to be toll booths. They're going to take pictures of your license plate when you cross. So they're keeping track of, when you cross and how often and all that good stuff. Now, that on its face wouldn't be so bad, although I still have a problem with it. But now we know about all these things with the NSA and private companies sharing information. So that's just one more thing that they can put together in the metadata to figure out what you're doing. I mean, they can already track your phone. They can now track. They'll be able to track your car by license plate. I've got another story coming up here later in the show about tracking credit card transactions. I mean, it's getting to the point now where the shorter list is what aren't they tracking? And I have a real big problem with this whole setup, from the whole monopoly granting to the private company to the ability to have this additional metadata added into what's already being collected about us.
Exactly. Information is the most valuable resource these days. And it's ironic that we're creating something the equivalent of out of the 1960s show The Prisoner, where the village keeps a constant surveillance eye on all the village residents. And number six is the only one who has the ability or the willpower and the mentality to actively resist what number two is trying to do all the time. There's kind of it was more than just cool science fiction. It was, in a way, a warning of what was getting ready to happen. And we are living in that virtual village these days.
Well, and certainly we're at a point now where, all these things that we've been warned about, and that's really the problem. I mean, I'm a technology guy. I work in technology, and I specifically work in data, right? I mean, I do backup and storage, and everything I'm storing and backing up is information. And certainly everybody's got their information. They want to keep it, and that makes sense. The real problem is how invasive is it going to get? And that's really my problem with this, It used to be one thing where you could go through and say, okay, I want to go look at everybody who bought something from us for the last 6 months that was over $10. I mean, that's something that, a normal sales organization might run once in a while just to find out, hey, who's been buying from us, who hasn't, try to make some sales calls, whatever. What's happening now is they're extrapolating this data from multiple sources, and they're able to determine what it is you might buy. And beyond, they're doing psychological profiling, basically, of individuals and then targeting ads at people. And that's the private sector side of what's going on. And then the public sector side, the NSA and whatnot, doing the same thing, but they're then trying to figure out, well, based on all this information, is this person a potential terrorist? And I have a real problem with the whole potential crime issue anyway. I don't like the idea of pre-convicting someone of wrongdoing before they've done anything. And, you know, that's another big issue with all of this stuff. But, you know, getting back to the core of this, I mean, the public-private partnership stuff is absolutely not good for the taxpayers, because our taxes, that's the other story that came out here this past week, we're paying more in fuel taxes than we've ever paid per gallon. And it begs the question, where's the money going? I mean, if we're paying more in taxes than we've ever paid, where's the money going? Why all of a sudden do we need alternate revenue sources to maintain our highways and infrastructure? I mean, if we're paying more than we ever have, then in theory, we should be getting more than we've ever received, or at least keeping pace with inflation, at least in theory, especially since the official numbers say we haven't had any inflation in about half a decade, which everybody knows is a lie, but that's another story. The point is, it really, I want to know where this money is. Where's the money going? Why is it that we're unable to build and expand and maintain the highways that are the most used in this state? You know, I-71 is finally getting fixed somewhat. But 71 between Cincinnati and Louisville is a very highly trafficked interstate that is way below standards. The shoulders are narrow. It's really not that safe of a highway, and especially when compared to something like 75, which the main problem on 75 is when you go through cities and they have the weird entrance-exit ramp stuff, and that down there by you, Randolph, where with the 64-75 juncture come on, split yeah. off, mess through that part of town. But, I mean, at least you've got shoulders there, and the road's got four or five lanes there, and, I mean, it's in good shape. The I-71 between Cincinnati and Louisville is basically two lanes on each way, four lanes total, and maybe has half a shoulder on each side. I mean, there's not even anywhere really to pull off safely in most places. Yeah. And they're always a very heavily traveled highway.
Even when they're fixed. Even when they're fixed, they're always in a constant state of disrepair, you've noticed. They're just...
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It seems like... I don't necessarily have a problem, for instance, if the private sector wants to hire a public company to do a job with a contract and a guarantee, and I have no problem with that side of it. You know, if Kentucky wants to hire a private company to build these bridges, and they pay X number of dollars for the bridge, and it comes with such and such guarantees, I have no real problem with that. I mean, as long as we're getting what we're paying for, I really don't necessarily care who builds it. My problem is that if we're just going to start giving away pieces of our public infrastructure to private companies and creating monopolies on core pieces, I mean, it's not like it's easy to just drop a bridge across the river somewhere. But somebody did point out something interesting to me, is that down halfway between between Louisville and Cincinnati, they're replacing a bridge there, and it's a two-lane bridge. And I believe that bridge only cost $100 million. And there was a big question about why is it that it's $100 million to put one new bridge in with two lanes, but to put one new bridge in with a total of eight lanes or six lanes, one or the other, cost $2.7 billion now. You know, and that's a big question. Why does it cost so much? Where is this money going? And honestly, not entirely sure it can't be built cheap. What's that?
Yeah, that's going to kickbacks. I mean, I guarantee you that money's lining somebody's pocket. And when they build roads in Germany, like the Autobahn, those roads are built to last. They're built with materials that are made to last. Here in this country, We build roads with the cheapest materials possible. We build them with all kinds of expensive labor where we take into account things like no-show employees and shady business practices. And then no wonder we get what we pay for in this sense. We're paying through the nose for a road that falls apart after only 3 or 4 years. Germany's roads are built to last. They're built to last like 50, aren't they?
I had heard that some of the original Autobahn lanes are still in use today. Now, certainly, you know, they have, and I've driven on the Autobahn, they have far less traffic than we do. I mean, we're much more a car-driven society than they are in Europe in general. But, you know, it goes without saying that even still, you know,
you should be using materials that's actually going to hold up to the amount of traffic that's going to be going on that road.
Right. And understand, I mean, no infrastructure is infinite, right? We're never going to have anything that lasts forever. But, yeah, I mean, I remember projects back in the late 80s or early 90s where they put a road down and 4 years later the thing's crumbling apart again. And here they come, you know, to patch it up. And it's like, well, wait a second, you guys just poured, you tore every inch of this highway out and re-poured the whole thing. How are we back at this situation 3 or 4 years later where the whole thing's all messed up again? You know, and that's the kind of thing where if you're going to have somebody do it, you got to have a guarantee on it, right? And have penalties and all that kind of stuff. I mean, this is just contract law, and these things can be written. I get really frustrated when we see things like this that, again, we have the highest tax per gallon we've ever had, and yet for some reason we supposedly don't have the money to maintain the highways. I'd really like to know where all that money has gone because I don't know. I certainly have no idea where that money went. It went somewhere, and like you said, it's probably lining somebody's pocket. But – all right, well, we're actually about to the bottom of the hour, Vance, or Randolph. I keep calling you Vance, and I don't know why. Randolph.
You're fine. It's all good, man. All good.
But anyhow, we're hitting the bottom of the hour. I want to take a quick break. I got a bunch of stuff to get to. I'm going to talk to you in the break. Folks, if you can hang on with us here through the bottom of the hour break, we're going to take a 3-4 minute break here and then come right back. We have a ton more to cover. We've just scratched the surface. So hold on tight. Again, if you'd like to call in, the number here is 858-683-1326. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network, and we'll be back here in just a few minutes.
We'll be right back. Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springsteen of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. It is Sunday night. If you are listening to the podcast, I want to invite you to listen to us live and, in fact, call into the show. We always enjoy having people call in live. I think that it adds to the conversation to have that back and forth and more of a live back and forth. So obviously want to encourage folks, we're here every Sunday night at 7 p.m., barring some sort of unforeseen circumstance, like a holiday or a family event that I can't escape from. We are here every Sunday. So join us live and tune in and interact with the show. But, all right, I'm going to get back to it here. And before I bring Randolph back on, Randolph's in the queue. I talked to him during the break, and he had a few things he wanted to bring up. I wanted to wrap up the stuff on the public-private partnership stuff. And one of the interesting things that's happening is Kentucky right now is in the process of getting out of the private prison business. Basically, they're going to stop using private prisons for housing inmates. And there's a good number of reasons for that, and I don't want to go into all of them, but there is good reason to question private prisons. Whenever you're policing for profit, that's not a good thing. We should be policing because we have to, not because we want to, not because it's a moneymaker, not because somebody's getting paid. And if anything, we should be losing money on incarceration. And I say that meaning that there should be a disincentive to incarcerate people. If you look at what the founding fathers said about the juries and about the burden of proof and innocent until proven guilty, I think the phrase was either 100 or 1,000 guilty people should go free would be better than incarcerating one person who was innocent. And, you know, when we start policing for profit, it flips the equation the other way. We're now focused on bringing in money and revenue at avenue or through that avenue. And that's not a good thing. We don't want to create incentives to incarcerate people. We should have disincentives to incarcerate people so that only those who truly need to be incarcerated are the ones who are incarcerated. I mean, I hope people understand what I'm saying there. Here's another example of that. And I've seen a bit of this here lately. Jefferson County is doing it, but I know other counties are too. I believe Lexington, Fayette is doing it as well. And I'm going to bring Randolph back in for this conversation to see if he knows. Hey, Randolph, have you looked into or seen anything about this stuff where the county attorneys in individual counties are now charging they're running their own traffic schools so that the county attorney's office and thus the county gets the money instead of the state? Have you seen that?
No, I haven't, but that would make sense. So, I think they're shifting over the responsibilities of the state transportation cabinet for the driving instructors to where they issue your driver's license, and they're shifting that over to the county level, aren't they?
Well, this is actually a big fight. It's an interesting thing. Basically, the state is not happy about this because what's essentially happening is the county attorneys are saying, hey, if you go to my traffic school, then I'll drop the charges, the charge being speeding or whatever the traffic offense was.
There has to be a uniform to that. There has to be one set rule for all the counties to follow and adhere to. And you can't have a system like that.
Well, and that's today what we had, right, for as long as I remember, was state driving school, state traffic school. And what's happened is these county attorneys are getting around that because they control who gets prosecuted and who doesn't. So essentially they're saying, if you go to my traffic school, I'll drop the ticket. And what's interesting, so in Jefferson County, the ticket state traffic school, if you go in person, is $149. If you do it online, it's $181.50. The Jefferson County Attorney's class is $150. And I believe that it is also online. Yes, it's online as well. So basically, they're undercutting the state by $31, but they're pocketing the money instead of it going to the state. And so the state is obviously a little displeased about this, but it's setting up an interesting legal challenge. And what I want to know is, what would stop me as a private company from doing the same thing? If they're going to be allowed to start up their own traffic school in the county, why can't the private traffic school start up and charge $75 to do it online? I mean, these things are kind of a joke. I mean, I don't know if you've ever gone to state traffic school. I have.
I have to. I got to see the Disney Goofy videos where he demonstrates road rage.
Yes.
So, yes.
Yes, yes, yes. That's the state traffic school. Yes, I've been to that. And then they show you all the nice, gruesome pictures at the end. And, yeah, it doesn't teach anything. All it is a way to punish you in a different way. The upside of it is it keeps the points off your license. And that's really the key, is that it keeps the points off your license. And in Kentucky, most insurance companies do your rates based on how many points you have on your license. So long as you keep the points off your license, then your insurance doesn't go up. And that's the kind of the game there. And since we're all forced to have insurance, there's no real competition there. So that's the game that's played, but I think it's kind of interesting. It's policing for profit.
Yeah, I could see the Ricky Bobby School of driving instructing school. Shake and bake.
You know, the thing is, today, in theory, most of the traffic fine money actually ends up in Frankfurt. And then Frankfurt may send some back, but there's nothing that defines that per se. But the traffic fines go to Frankfurt. This pretty much keeps it all in that county. And I remember, it seems to me, some years back, the way it worked is that there was a small amount, either $5 or $10, that stayed with the county or the entity that wrote the ticket, and then the rest went to Frankfurt. And this was back when tickets were a lot cheaper. Now they're ridiculous.
It gives cops more of an incentive. It gives cops more of incentives to crack down on what they think is speeding. And also that whole changing the light cycles on the timing cycles on yellow lights from like 6 seconds down to 2. So
right. And in fact, I've got a story on that here somewhere. Where did I put that story? I've got things printed and scattered all over the darn place, but the city of Cincinnati has been having problems with traffic cameras. There it is right there. I have to grab the story here. Oh, there we go. So essentially, they had a private company that was writing these tickets for the city on behalf of the city. And exactly what you're talking about happened, right? They changed timing on the lights to boost the profit. Honestly, that kind of scares me, too. That's a good way to get people killed. I mean, if there's any bad thing in traffic that can really happen, it's getting T-boned, right? When you get hit on the side by somebody coming at 90 degrees another direction, because the human body does not react well to a hit from the side. And also our vehicles aren't really built for that either. And I guess the point is that when you start dorking around with traffic light timings in order to boost your profits, what you're really doing is putting people's lives at risk for boosting your bottom line. So this company was just held in contempt of court and has ordered that all of the cameras be taken down. This came out on it was Saturday, July 6th, so about just over a week ago. They had this come out because and he ordered them all taken down because the company that put them up, despite the fact that the judge had ordered a stay and despite the fact that the judge had ordered that all tickets written by these cameras or as a result of these cameras were null and void, the private company behind it was still collecting fines for people running the lights and getting zinged with their cameras. And it's pretty interesting. Again, it's policing for profit, and law enforcement should not be profit. It should be for safety, and there are certainly, some times when it's necessary, but, more often than not, most of the violations having to do with traffic are for speeding, and most of them are not for speeding a ridiculous, 25 or 50 over or anything crazy. It's for 10 or 15 over. And the reality is our vehicles are actually built much better than they used to be. The safety standards are much higher than they used to be. And it's really unnecessary to be so strict on those speed limits. Additionally, you have weird issues where, for whatever reason, a road is marked way too slow for what it really should be. And in fact, there have been lawsuits in the past. People get tickets and sue all, the wrong person gets a ticket and they sue and they're successful at getting not only their ticket thrown out, but the speed limit on that stretch of road raised. I mean, there's no reason that some of these highways are marked at a speed that it doesn't make any sense. And it's like, well, wait, why is it this low? One ticket I got that I remember clearly was in Henderson, Kentucky, where basically the stretch of highway is an extension of the parkway, but because it isn't officially the parkway, the speed limit there is 55. Now, the parkway speed limit is 70. So I thought I was on the parkway. So I was doing literally 71 miles an hour is how fast I was going, and I have a ticket to prove that. Not even thinking I was speeding, really, right? I mean, I had it set to 70 on the cruise control. Okay, it drifted up to 71, whatever. Thought that I was just cruising along. I wasn't in a hurry and got a ticket. And why? I mean, the road was certainly up to the standards of the parkway. There's entrance and exit ramps. There's no 90-degree entrance or entrances or exits. But, it all seems very arbitrary to me what the speed limit is. And I have to question whether there's been real speed studies done on these roads or if it's just, well, this sounds good. Let's just put a speed limit here. And
I mean, even in the sections of Fayette County where you have 75, 64 in that corridor, they're roughly 65 to 70. Now, there might be some sections where... Yeah, we're at 65 to 70 on the speed limit. You might have some sections where it might have to drop down. You might have to drop it down to 55, but that's in rare cases where the road's getting ready to split off or something, and they want you to be slower and a little more cautious. But
typically a 55 mile an hour speed limit on any interstate class highway these days is when you're going through a city. So unlike Lexington, where the highway kind of goes around the city, if you're going into Louisville, downtown Louisville, the speed limit's going to be 55 because you have short entrance and exit ramps, and that's why. There's only so much braking and so much accelerating you can do to get off and on the highway without getting somebody killed, which makes sense that those are 55. I wish they would redesign those highways so they wouldn't have to be. But, again, that's really the only place where 55 is really necessary on a limited access. In other words, has entrance and exit ramps, highway. And, again, it's policing for profit. And that's my big problem with it, is that we should not be policing for profit. It should not be about making money for the state. It should be about doing the right thing.
Yeah, doing away with the private prisons is the best thing Kentucky could ever do. You remember that scandal with the judge up in Pennsylvania who was sentencing all these kids to a private juvenile facility, and they finally caught him because he was taking bribes from the prison officials that were running that prison. So it happens. Yeah,
right.
There is incentive. Yeah, to put asses in the seats, as it were.
Well, and the problem there is that the more quote-unquote legal way, I mean, that guy got caught because they started just giving him money straight up. Most of the time what it turns into is campaign contributions and things like that, which are perfectly legal to do. You know,
he was taking like $630,000, I think, from that one group.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah. Sheer greed got him.
Yeah, that might have been a little much even for paid finance. Allowances, but you know, again, we should not be policing for profit. It should be about public safety and doing the right thing, not about how many dollars we're bringing in, and not about. I mean, in Campbell County, they admitted we have a county police department up here. The county police, the chief, admitted on TV that there is a quota, and in fact, they fired someone for not meeting their quota for writing speeding tickets. I mean, that's crazy. Why do we care? I mean, if we actually get to the point where people are not driving unsafe, shouldn't there not be a quota? Shouldn't it be left to the discretion of the officer involved whether or not the person was engaging in dangerous behavior rather than some arbitrary thing where, you need to write 20 tickets a week or else you're fired?
You know, it takes away the responsibilities that they should be doing, like, you know, protecting the citizens. That should be first. Writing tickets should be like, you know, it shouldn't be a quota system. That should be like an afterthought. It's like, oh, well, unfortunately, I have to write you a ticket. It's like, now we're just giving them excuses to write you a ticket. Oh, you got a taillight busted out. Smash. Oh, you got a headlight busted out, too. Smash. So.
Yeah, well, you know, and I don't know, I get really frustrated with the whole problem because, you know, it's really not that hard to do this job right. The ironic thing about it is the police often bemoan that the public doesn't respect them enough. And it's like, well, of course not, dude. You wrote a bunch of people BS tickets, and it happens month after month, and it's not just you, it's every other cop, too. Gee, what do you think? Do you think that's positive for your image? Do people go around saying, gee, I'm glad I got that ticket that was stupid? What do you think is going to come of it? Of course people are going to have a more negative impression of the police as a result. And so the point is that if somebody's doing something stupid, sure, absolutely, you know, stop them from doing that. But if somebody's doing 66 and a 55, certainly they're not doing anything, you know, unless they're driving erratically otherwise. It's really not worth bothering people over that. I mean, especially, you know, traffic conditions play in. If they're not weaving it on traffic, if they're maintaining their lane and driving safely and everything, who cares? Who cares?
Driving in the pack. You always got to stay in the center of the pack if you can. They always it's the stragglers. It's the stragglers they always kept. The ones that, you know, stray away from the pack.
It depends. But
yeah.
Well, I want to move on, and we're coming up on the top of the hour, and I've got a ton of stuff I still need to cover here.
NSA surveillance, yes.
Yeah, so
NSA,
I've got a ton on that stuff. You know, the Snowden stuff, and I know we talked about that during the break, too. You wanted to bring some of this up. One of the stories I've got here is that the leaks themselves that Snowden has come out with have caused a, quote, massive shift in the public's view of government surveillance. And what's interesting about this is that, let me see if I can find this study. Here we go. So back in January of 2010, 25% of the people said that the government surveillance went too far, and about 63-64% said it didn't go far enough. Now, in July of 2013, basically, you know, last week, we're now at 45% say it's gone too far and 40% say it's not far enough. So we've had a drastic swing to the point where people who think it's gone too far now outnumber the people who say it hasn't gone far enough, which is good. I mean, that's a good thing. We want people to realize that. I saw something online that it made – it was kind of one of those Facebook meme things where – they said, no, the government is supposed to be transparent, and we're supposed to spy or know what's going on with government. Private citizens are supposed to be left alone and, you know, ask the question, when did this equation get flip-flopped? Because now we're at a point where government wants to keep itself secret and not transparent, which, by the way, breeds, whenever government is not transparent, it breeds distrust. I mean, it... And it's funny how many government agencies don't get this. The different bureaucracies I've dealt with and talked to, they don't get that part of the reason that the public is so mad half the time is because they're not fully transparent with what they're doing. And if they actually just went out and told people what they were doing and why, then people would go, oh, okay, I kind of get it. And you would see a 5 to 10% bump in support for their program, whatever it is, just because they're being transparent. So But the point is that we should never have a government that is able to hide what they're doing to us in order to protect us. I mean, it is – it's one thing for the government to have secrets about what we're doing militarily in other countries and whatever, right? I mean, that's one thing. It's a whole other thing for the government to be protecting us by not telling us what they're doing to us. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, no, we're supposed to be accountable. The government is supposed to be accountable to us. And if we don't know what they're doing to us, then there's no way that we can hold them accountable. I mean, that just makes sense.
Why is it that Microsoft is allowing the NSA to bypass the encryption on Microsoft's cloud storage service for its users? Why is it that the Microsoft is allowing the NSA to snoop on over 175,000 Skype call users? I mean, yeah, I use Skype.
It's not just
now,
Microsoft.
Yeah, you were. Yeah, now that just makes me want to not
Verizon.
Use Skype. Yeah.
Sure. It's not just them. It's Verizon. It's lots of different companies. And I had a story probably a month or two ago about how the NSA basically left these companies with very little choice. The way this is set up is the NSA comes in and says, we want this. And as a private company, you can say, no. And they'll produce you a warrant or an order from their little secret NSA court that they have set up that is their check and balance that we're not allowed to know about either. And, oh, okay, well, now what do we do? And as part of that order, it says, by the way, you're not allowed to discuss what we're doing with you, right? So basically it puts the company in a position where they can't complain. There's a court ruling against any sort of fighting it, and they're not even allowed to sue to say we don't want this to happen because that would be taking it public and thus a violation of a court order. So these companies are getting caught in a scenario where they have to comply. Now, some of them obviously are more willing to comply than others. And some of the initial data that came out from Snowden with PRISM and whatnot, you can kind of tell based on who was an early adopter and who was late to get on the train as to who was more cooperative than the other as far as the companies were concerned. But
collaborators.
At the end of the
collaborators,
day,
yeah.
Right, right. But at the end of the day, you know, this article made a very good point that because these warrants that the NSA provides or these orders from these secret courts specifically say, hey, you're not allowed to complain about this publicly or else, you know, you're in contempt of this court order, it basically makes it so they have to comply and can't complain about it. And it's horrible. I mean, the scope of this is amazing. I mean, and what was it, the last week or two, we just found out that the NSA is basically – surveilling all emails and all phone calls, and now has, you know, across the world, and now Europe's all up arms over this.
Email surveillance has been going on for much longer than you think. That started roughly around 1992 at the Menwith Hill listening post in the United Kingdom. And that was an active partnership between MI5 and the CIA. So they've been actively tracking the world's email. It all goes through the Menwith Hill servers before it reaches its final destination. And then they intercept the world's email. They've been doing that since 1992.
Well, and what I find amazing is, you know, the NSA obviously is getting all the flack right now, but you bring up the CIA. You know, there's actually, and I've got another story here about how there are multiple government agencies keeping track of all your credit card transactions.
Of course.
And, and it's amazing because they're tracking everything. And I mean everything.
That makes it. Makes it even easier. Makes it even easier when, for a few dollars, you can get one of those little credit card readers plugged into your smartphone. And my business. I can do all my business through my iPhone. Here, just swipe your card, and we'll process your sale right here at the county fair. So,
right.
You know, that just makes it another level that they can track your data with. Credit cards swipe directly through a smartphone. Yeah.
And we're just about at the top of the hour, and I want to just mention one more thing on this before we hit the break. One of the things that came out because of all this is now there are specifically people trying to write applications that are basically hack-proof. And what I'm told, anyway, is that the real bad guys, the terrorists, have already done this, right? And that the only people they're really able to easily gather information on is us, like, you know, regular or normal people. Everybody else, the real bad guys, have already figured out, hey, we need to encrypt this stuff. And so they're already doing it. But a story that came out, the guy that started the Pirate Bay, which anybody who's used torrents has probably heard of the Pirate Bay. Pirate Bay is a repository of torrent data. So basically the way torrents work, you search for a seed torrent and whatever. Pirate Bay is kind of one of those places where you search for that. They are now working on creating an app for tapless or NSA-proof, as they put it, messaging, so that ideally you'll be able to communicate privately again. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out because obviously the NSA is not going to be real pleased with that development. And it should be very interesting to see what happens because – they're going to be based out of, I think, Pirate Base based out of Sweden, I think. It's somewhere in Europe.
They were, but Sweden kind of chased them out, so they're kind of without a country right now. I think that at one time they were even contemplating North Korea servers, and that kind of didn't sit over well for obvious reasons. But, you know, they've basically got to go somewhere. Anyway, yeah, top of the hour.
We're at the top of the hour. Yep, all right. I'll put you back in the hold. Folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We still have a ton of information. If you'd like to call in about this or anything else liberty-oriented going on, you can do so by calling area code 858-683-1326. And we'll be right back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network.
Reflects a complex hybrid dialect now. Detect a mesh of many elements compressed down. staff, the melting pot of a super futuristic style. The combination of a vocal caress with lungs that gasp for breath from emotional stress to special effects. In a distorted collage, carefully lies between beats of a rhythmic barrage. It's going down, the logical progression on the timeline. The separation narrowed down to a fine line. To blur the edges so they blend together properly. Take you on an audible odyssey. Now it's going down.
Put it out for the world to see. LP and X-Men, you're the 10th degree. Nobody in the world to see. When we melt down, the wax from your extra free. Put it out for the world to see. LP and X-Men, you're the 10th degree. Nobody in the world to see. When we melt down, the wax from your extra free.
Again, it is composed sentences, altogether venomous. The four elements, the natural force projected daily through the sound of the source. Everybody on board as we blend the sword with the pen. The mightiest of weapons, swinging mic to the chin to elevate mental states long gone with the wind to defend men from shoddy imitation. Pretend it's going down. Style assimilation, readily trekking through the weaponry of a pure pedigree. Cleverly seeing through whatever is ahead of me, whatever the weather be. We advancing steadily. It's going down, subterrestrial hot. A rhyme regiment that's calling the shot. An execution of collaborative plots, ready to bring the separation of style to a stop. It's going down, a logical progression on the timeline. The separation narrowed down to a fine line. To blur the edges so they blend together properly. Take you on an audible odyssey. Now it's going down.
Put it out for the world to see. LP and X-Men, you're the 10th degree.
It's going down.
Nobody in the world is safe. When we melt down, the wax in your extra free.
It's going down.
Put it out for the world to see. LP and X-Men, you're the 10th degree.
It's going down.
We're back, hour number two on Liberty Unbridled and the My View Matters Radio Network. Welcome back. For those that missed the first hour, we had Randolph Vance, who has been a candidate for the 6th District Congressional seat as an independent in 2012, was with us. And he has left the show, and he had to get on doing other things, and we certainly appreciate him coming on. If you'd like to join the show, the number here is area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. Now, we're usually here for only 1 hour, but there's so much information to cover that we needed two tonight. So that's why the two-hour show tonight. All right, so getting back to it here and getting it on, because we've got a lot to cover and only an hour to do it. A new study came out that shows that, or confirms that, cutting federal regulations actually lowers unemployment. Now, those that own a business have known this, you know, inherently for quite some time, that government regulation prevents them from growing. And specifically right now, the main thing that's kept us in the recession that we've been in for the past few years that people may not realize is Obamacare has been the primary reason why businesses have not been expanding. And because of that, a lot of businesses that would like to expand, I've talked to many small business owners, and I've talked about this on the show before, many small business owners would like to expand. There's opportunities to expand, but they're afraid of the mandate and don't know what it means for their business. They're small business owners. Today, they're under the limit, right? So they don't have the 50 employee or 50 full-time. It comes up to 2,000 man hours a week. I can never say it the right way. But basically 2,000 hours worth of paid hours a week is the limit before you have to have or until you fall into Obamacare. And as such, many employers just are afraid to do anything. Additionally, nobody really knows what this is all going to cost. And again, as a result, many employers are just kind of in a sit and wait pattern. So you have a number of things going. The business community is not really anxious to make any moves until this kind of shakes out. And additionally, you know, coming out of recessions typically is in part driven by small businesses. Small businesses are the ones that take the big risks. Many times it's because they've lost their main job and have decided that if they're going to go broke, they're going to go broke doing something they like, and maybe it'll work out. So that is what tends to help drive us out of recession, and one of the main pieces that's missing in this recession, because people aren't starting new businesses. It's not just Obamacare. I mean, I don't want to place the full blame on that. I mean, certainly local regulations, state regulations, taxes that never go down. There's a lot of paperwork and heartache and pain involved in starting a company. And I admire all those that have done it and continue to fight that battle. But I've talked to a lot of small business owners who said, you know what, if I had to do it all over again today, I'd probably not do it. Not, you know, if I knew all this was coming when I started my business, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever it was, I wouldn't have done all this. And it ripples. I mean, understand that it doesn't just stop there. One of the stories that came out this past week is that now only 47% of adults have a full-time job, and that the nation's second largest employer is a temp agency. Why is that? Because, first of all, temps are easy to get rid of. Secondly, they're trying to split these duties out in a way, part-time temp work, because they want to be able to get rid of these people more easily in order to comply with all these possible regulations. I mean, they don't have all this figured out. Understand, and I've got stories on this coming up, they don't know what they're going to do yet. Some of this stuff, it was widely reported that part of Obamacare, the mandate was rolled back to 2015, but it's not the whole mandate, it's just part of the mandate. And the main problem is they don't know how in the world they're going to enforce it. And that's why they've put it off. It's not that they're not going to. It's not that they're going to scrap it. Certainly, you know, with Obama still as president and the Congress being as broken and dysfunctional as it is, nothing's going to change. I mean, Republicans could have defunded this thing a long time ago and didn't, so I don't think that's going to change either. But essentially, we're creating a scenario where the healthcare system is just broke. It's not functioning properly. The Treasury Department is delaying a part of the employer mandate, but not all of it, apparently. And none of the stories go into the nuances enough. I'm actually hoping to hit a business seminar, I think that's coming up this month, that's supposed to give updates on what's going on with Obamacare and what pieces are going and what pieces are on delay. And it's all confusing. And make no mistake, that confusion right there is why business owners want to expand. There's too much doubt. There's too much uncertainty to go invest more of your own money. Make no mistake, folks, if you've never run a small business or if you don't know a small business owner, the way small businesses work is their profit, they don't have a 401k. What they do with their profit is they plow it back into the business to grow the business. Their retirement asset, generally, is mostly their business. And the idea is that they run it for 20, 30 years, and then they either turn it over to a relative or they sell it. And that's their retirement plan. And so they're not going to put their retirement at risk. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And so, and I don't blame them. I mean, you know, I wouldn't put my retirement fully at risk either. You know, that's why even in my 401k, I'm very well diversified because I'm not willing to put myself at such risk that I could lose it all. I mean, who in their right mind would do that? And that's exactly it. These business owners are not willing to reinvest in their business because there's too much uncertainty out there to do it. And so they're not going to do it. And, well, that's where it is. What's interesting is another story came out. Let's see. That came out Monday. Interesting story about in Oklahoma City, a hospital or a healthcare provider anyway, posted their surgery prices online. And what they basically do is say, okay, here is our flat rate for this type of surgery. And by doing that, essentially you go to your primary care physician, you get the referral, right, that says, yeah, I need this procedure. And they're going to do it for a flat rate amount. And what's interesting about it is it's created a bidding war, a price war on healthcare services. Essentially, this story, it's very, very interesting. There's a gentleman here in the story, 22 years old, tore his patella tendon and dislocated his kneecap. He lives in California, and he doesn't have insurance. Surgery in California was going to be $30,000, $30,000 to get that fixed. The Surgery Center of Oklahoma had it posted on their site that the price was $5,700. It's less than 20% of the $30,000 price that he was being told in California. So he and his father flew to Oklahoma and had the surgery, and they still saved money. If you want to really fix health care, then you need to put the free market back into it. We have the Certificate of Need program that specifically limits who and how much health care can be given in an area. And they determine, oh, well, there's too many hospital beds here, so you can't build another hospital. You can't be a health care provider here. And combine that with the e-record stuff and combine that with Obamacare. And what we're seeing is that everything is collapsing down into regional monopolies. And make no mistake, once the regional monopolies are established, they'll collapse down further into national monopolies. That's what's happening now. What we should be doing is encouraging competition. We should be encouraging fixed rate pricing. We should be encouraging transparency in the marketplace. And as much as, you know, he has his faults, supposedly the health care plan that I have, which is a health savings account combined with a high deductible health plan, which unfortunately becomes illegal at the end of this year courtesy of Obamacare. Yes, I don't get to keep my insurance. That plan, the idea behind it, was to try to create consumer-side incentives to control cost. And that's one ingredient, just one ingredient. If you could provide to me your – if there were all these different providers that were available and they all had prices listed online, and it's my money, right? That's how the HSA works, is I spend my money that's been set aside for medical purposes. I get to decide how to spend that money. And if I decide to go to Joe Bob's Discount Knee Repair and Auto Body, well, that's on me. If I decide to go to, you know, the number one knee specialist in the country, well, that's on me. If I decide to go to somewhere in between, that, well, again, that's on me. You know, that's how real market forces work and how things are kept in balance, is that there's a market price for a good or service that someone wants to buy. That's how the free market keeps prices in check. And that's the problem, is that we haven't had a free market in healthcare for decades. And as a result, our prices have been spiraling out of control for decades. That's your real problem with healthcare. And getting more government involved with the Obamacare plan is going to make it worse. It is going to fail. is going to be a mess. There is no doubt in my mind that it is not going to work. All right, switching gears. Let's see here. I've got, let's go with this. So a little bit on the nanny state report here. We've got a number of different things this week on the nanny state report. Typically, nanny state stuff is limited mostly to consumption, but in this scenario, what's interesting is Florida just passed a ban, and they're trying to ban online gambling. That's what they're trying to do. And in Florida specifically, online gambling, it's kind of complex, but the very short version is the theory is that there is only a limited pool of discretionary income available. And so what will happen is there will be fights over where that discretionary income can be spent. There will be people pushing for bans on certain types of activities in order to corral those discretionary dollars into some other outlet. That's the theory anyway. And so Florida, being the home to Disney, which is a discretionary income black hole of the universe, I'm pretty sure, at least it is for me, my family. The point, I guess, is that in Florida, they just tried to pass a ban on online gambling. And in typical government fashion, just like they do here in the state of Kentucky when they try to ban something, they make it too broad. They make it too wide. They because there's always a loophole if you make it specific. So they try to make these very broad laws. Well, the way this law is worded is basically if a thing can be used for online gambling, then it's illegal. That's pretty much what they've done in this law. And what's happening instead is instead of banning just the, as they say in the story, the online bingo and online slot type games, which of course the state lottery wants and the other people would want, the other discretionary income folks, they basically banned a computer or anything that's capable of running an application that allows people to gamble, which is a smartphone or a computer or a tablet or pretty much anything. And you know, you'll hear people say, well, it's for the good of the society to protect people from being taken advantage of by these scourge of gambling. The reality is it's about protecting profit and trying to accumulate a larger piece of the discretionary income pie. That's the real push behind this. I'm not doubting that some people really truly believe, and even some of the elected officials, that they don't truly believe that gambling is a matter of morality. But for the most part, the real concern here is income. It has nothing to do with right or wrong. But, you know, whatever. They have banned it, and it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out in court. And, of course, in typical fashion, and I don't know how Florida courts work, We saw the Zimmerman trial, but that was a grand jury. That's not where this will end up, probably. What we see is the courts trying to narrow or determine a objective limit and create objective limits on what can and can't be done based on a subjective law that was passed hastily, either to get brownie points with certain constituents, or to do whatever. It's a mess, and all they've done is create a new legal mess, and the taxpayers of Florida will be paying for it. So good for you. Meanwhile, other nanny state stuff, nanny state update. This came out July 9th, which was Tuesday. Interesting story. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control, is saying that Americans still consume too much salt. but that new studies show there is no benefit in reducing salt. So we consume too much, but there's no benefit to consuming that much or consuming less than what we consume. Okay, so we've got too much, but there's no benefit of consuming less. And actually what's interesting, they go through this story, and what actually changed this is that there is a level of reaching too little salt. And it's very interesting. Some of the studies that were done that counteracted this whole too much salt, too much salt, too much salt, too much salt. And in essence, what came out of it is that most Americans consume between 2 and 3 teaspoons of salt per day. And that what they found in the studies, the overall theme here is that between 1.5 and 3 teaspoons of salt per day is fine. 3 teaspoons is a tablespoon, for the record, for those of you who don't know. But what they also found is that if you're getting less than 0.5 teaspoon of salt per day, it's actually hurting you. Yeah, all these people that say you need to cut salt out of your diet, yeah, you need salt. There is something to be said for some salt. I mean, you need some. And, in fact, the worst thing that low salt causes is insulin sensitivity. So the point is, once again, science, they build legislation around salt, like in New York, the salt ban stuff and all that they did or tried to do, Bloomberg tried to do, the chief nanny up there. And now it turns out that it's bunk. The science it's based on, yeah, not so accurate. And boy, oops, gee, darn, well, ooh, sorry. But that won't stop them. They'll still push that stuff. You know, anytime there's a study that comes out, the entrenched powers, the people with the money built around protecting their little fiefdom of research, will come out with some other study that shows how this was actually flawed. And this is going to go back and forth for the next decade or so. And that's just how this works. I mean, we're still doing this with butter, with cholesterol, with all this stuff. It's so very stupid, really. Listen, folks, you eat too much of one thing, it's going to make you sick. Too much of anything is bad. Too little can be bad. Do what's right for you. You know what's right for you. I mean, right? Everybody knows what's right for them. I know what's right for me. I don't always do it, but I know what's right for me. And I'm sure you know what's right for you. We don't need the government interfering with that. I mean, it's crazy. Absolutely crazy that the government has the urge to control our individual consumption. But that's how nannies work. Nannies can't stop being nannies. They want to be your surrogate mom and dad and use the force of government to do it. They think your lifestyle is stupid, and they're going to pass a law to make sure you can't engage in it. And it's not just with salt. It's not just with smoke. It's on a lot of different things. And the reality is individuals are going to do what individuals do. And all you're doing is punishing them unnecessarily. And don't forget, one of these days, there will be a day of reckoning for you, the nanny, as well, when one of your favorite activities is deemed bad and illegal as well. So, anyway, got a couple stories here about bad law enforcement, and then we're going to take a bottom-of-the-hour break. So there was a story that came out, the end of June, about a University of Virginia student who came out of a liquor store and had bought water, bottled water. And the agents, the alcohol ABC agents, which is, Alcohol Beverage Control, which is what we call them here in Kentucky as well, it doesn't surprise me. Alcohol Beverage Control agents that were plain clothes rushed her vehicle and didn't show ID. They showed a badge, but the badge didn't, clearly say, oh, here's what we are. And so the lady panicked. She jumped in her car. backed out. Apparently, two of the agents were brushed by her vehicle, whatever that means. And then as she pulled out onto the street, she dialed 911 to find out if it was legit. And at that same time, one of the ABC officers actually had a car with a light bar and put up behind her and turned on the lights. And then with time, she pulled over. Now, she obviously was not trying to get away. What happened was, and it's very plausible, as she said, just a bunch of strange men ran up on her with guns. And so she jumped in her car and took off. I mean, if three or four guys with guns came after you, what would you do? And, you know, the fact that they claim to be law enforcement, there's all these stories online about women being raped and all this stuff by people who claim to be law enforcement, most of which, by the way, are urban legends, in case you're wondering. But the point is, you know, it's not a big surprise. You know, she ran off. And thankfully, nothing horrible, horrible happened other than she got arrested and she ended up having to spend the night in jail for, I think, assault, supposedly, with her vehicle grazed. That's the word, grazed. And so, yeah, I mean, crazy. Yeah. So anyway, the police didn't dispute that original version of the story, but now they do because obviously it makes them look bad. Meanwhile, also in Virginia, a female Sunday school teacher was shot to death by a police officer. The police officer apparently supposedly rolled up her window on his arm and dragged him down the street. But an eyewitness account said that that was not what happened, that she started to drive off and he just started firing shots into the vehicle. And so it killed the Sunday school teacher. And very unfortunate that, you know, whatever it was, I guarantee whatever a Sunday school teacher was being talked to by a police officer about was not something that she should have been shot over. It was probably something that was just something that you get a ticket over, if that. So, you know, I have friends that are officers, and my friends that are officers know when to use force and when not to. Unfortunately, not all officers do. So be careful. That's, I guess, the theme to that one. Be careful. But we're at the bottom of the second hour, and we got about 30 minutes left. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, got a few stories to wrap up with, and then we'll close the show. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. Back in a few minutes.
For the broken hearted.
All right, folks, we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. Let's see here. Getting back to it here, a few miscellaneous stories. We talked about police abuses before break. And this one ties into that and is rather unfortunate. The Supreme Court is, I'm sure everybody's heard now, this is 2 or 3 weeks old now, has decided that your silence can be against you. And it was a 5-4 ruling, decided that if you don't specifically invoke your right to silence, then you have no right to silence, which seems kind of funny because then you have to talk to invoke your right to not talk. And it's very disheartening. I hope that this doesn't set precedent that you have to declare that you're using all of your rights before you use them. I mean, do I have to declare that I want my right to the Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment and First Amendment? I'm declaring that I'm going to use my free speech now. I'm declaring that I have a right to firearms before I have a right to firearms. These rights are supposed to be inalienable. And the idea that you have to declare your rights is kind of crazy. I mean, I don't understand. I don't see how you can get to a point where you have to declare your rights in order to have them. I thought that's what the Bill of Rights was all about. We were allowed to have these rights, and they were inalienable, and that we didn't have to declare them. They were just there. But now we have to declare them. So just remember that, folks, that next time you have any sort of right that you're invoking, you must specifically invoke that right by saying so. According to the Supreme Court, because while this only right now applies to your right to remain silent, obviously that sets a precedent that all your rights must be declared if you plan on using them. And that's a terrible precedent. But, you know, hey, as long as you declare it, I guess it's all good, right? It makes no sense to me. It really, really doesn't. But let's see here. I'm, again, dealing with my printer issue here, and I've got stuff scattered all over trying to figure out what was what. Oh, here's something here. You know, there's a lot of people that make a big fuss about Walmart moving into a community. And, you know, full disclosure, I used to work for Walmart a long time ago. Not a big fan, and honestly, I don't like going to Walmart because it takes like 7 hours to get through the checkout lane. It takes literally twice as long to get out of the store than it does to go in, find my stuff, and get in line. I hate that. Hate it. And so I don't shop at Walmart a whole lot because of that. I just don't like having to wait to give you money. It's so stupid. It's so anti-logical. I don't understand at all. Anyway, in Washington, D.C., the city basically passed a law, or I'm sorry, they took a, let's see how this went here. Did they actually pass a law? I thought they actually passed it. This says they had a preliminary vote to impose a higher minimum wage on large big box retailers. Now, what does that mean? That means they've created a law specific to companies with a certain number of employees or of a certain size or whatever. And that's kind of crazy that, I mean, in theory, if you have a small business that succeeds and gets bigger and bigger and bigger, there's going to come a point where all of a sudden you hit a ceiling or your model has to change, your minimum wage has to increase. They were talking about in this particular instance of putting the minimum wage at $12.50 an hour, which is essentially 1.5 employees worth of actual minimum wage. So in response, Walmart said, you know what, fine, we don't care. We're just not going to put one here anymore. We're going to stop building, and good luck. Now, what's ironic about that is in many cities, one of the big complaints are what are called, they call them food deserts. And essentially what it is, the what am I trying to say? The concept is that there are no grocery stores, no means of getting a grocery store or buying groceries within these cities. And so this big issue of, hey, there are no grocery stores in our city could be resolved by a store like Walmart moving into that city. And it's very interesting to me that the city then turns around and says, yeah, we don't want your kind of grocery store here. We don't want your kind of store here. This whole food desert thing must be a complete joke then, because if they're not serious about bringing in new businesses, then whatever. I guess they don't care about their food desert. I guess they don't care about all that. And, you know, it's just kind of stupid. I'm not a big Walmart fan. I certainly don't think that a city should be allowed to impose special rules that basically specifically target Walmart in any way. I mean, the rules should apply equally across the board, and that's that. I mean, that's what equal protection is all about, and that's what makes sense. Let's see. Shifting gears here. More government waste. The FCC is wasting the phone subsidy money, which that's the money that's supposed to help pay for the phone service for poor people. And it's also the fund, by the way, that goes to Obama phones, as they're called, although technically that program started under Bush. For whatever reason, everybody calls them Obama phones now. The program is to supposedly give poor people access to the telephone network, to communication. I don't really know how I feel on that particular program in general, but, you know, as in every government program, it seems like if there's a bunch of money flowing through, then there's a bunch of waste as well, and that's kind of what the story goes into. They talk about how some of the rich areas of the country are getting up to $23,000 per line per year from the Universal Service Fund. $23,000. Now, that's an awful lot for a phone line, especially in a well-to-do community. It makes really no sense that you would ever need $23,000 for a single phone line ever. I mean, even running a dedicated line for, oh boy, how far was that? This has been 10 or 15 years ago. I had a dedicated line run probably 40 miles, maybe 45 miles wire length, and it was a dedicated pair. This is back in the day, so it was for ISDN, and it was for work, to my home, and that was $800 to hook up. I think it was $200 or $300 a month. I think it was four. But even still, that's 50. Let's say it was $400 a month. That's $5,600 a year, and that's about the time anyway. It was a fancy dancy internet connection, internet connection. That it's amazing that $23,000 a year. I don't even know what you would be able to buy with that, but it would be quite a bit. Be quite a nice phone line at $23,000 a year. Another interesting story, there's a new pushback on EPA mandates on gas. We talked about the fuel tax being collected at record amounts here in Kentucky. But this is the federal EPA is pushing, and what they've actually been pushing is moving up from what is now known as E10. That's our traditional gas that contains up to 10% ethanol. They want to upgrade that to E15. And basically mandate that 15% of our gas is ethanol. Now, for those of you that don't know why that's bad for engines, so it's kind of an interesting thing. Rubber hoses that are used for fuel line in cars, and I know this because I've done research on this, either work really well for gas or really well for alcohol. And there's some stuff that works for both but does not work well. You know, alcohol and gas are both corrosive materials. and they will cause fuel lines to break down over time. So by having them together, and more ethanol you have running through a rubber fuel line meant for gas means that that fuel line is going to break down faster. Additionally, most vehicles are not made to run on ethanol at that quantity. And, you know, I've done the research on this. It's a very long story. At one time I looked at making a vehicle that would run on 100% ethanol. And what would it take to do that and also to produce your own ethanol? Boy, is that a mess. I mean, I could spend 20 minutes explaining just that. But the point is, cars that are made for ethanol have different mechanics about them, different compression ratios inside the engine, different fuel injectors, different fuel line. The whole system is not necessarily fundamentally different, but different enough that you can't just swap for the other. And the point is that making a switch from E10 to E15 for everyone, and that's what they're talking about, is switching all gas, regular gasoline that we know and love, to E15, would cause significant damage, especially to older cars. Older cars definitely would have trouble with that. Anything with a carburetor would really have some problems. You know, the real issue here is that you're subsidizing corn and subsidizing fuel, and so what they're trying to do basically is subsidize even more corn to be used as fuel rather than, I mean, if you're going to talk about, I just have this big problem with the whole thing. We should be letting the free market decide this stuff, and I don't know that we need to cut all the funding immediately. I think it's something that should be scaled back over the course of 5 to 10 years. But we should be getting all of the funding, all the extra money that goes in to fund the corn and fuel industries should be eliminated. And we should be having a true free market on gas and on fuel. And as the cost of gas increases, which I do think it would legitimately increase over time, but as that increases, there will be other counter pressures in the market to either find alternate sources of fuel, alternate engines that run on other types of fuel, or a complete shift in what people do. You'd see people drive less, whatever it is. That's the free market answer to that. And I really believe that that's what, again, that industry needs more than anything, is a lot more free market and a lot fewer handouts. You know, is corn a viable crop for fuel? In the grand scheme of things, not really. You know, and of course, a big part of this is that it drives the whole GMO thing with growing more corn and making sure you have a higher yield harvest. And it creates all kinds of other problems when you subsidize corn rather than letting the free market just do its thing. And that's what we should be doing, is letting the free market do its thing. Boy, here's one. Yeah, I meant to bring this up earlier when we were talking about small governments. I apologize. My printer was messed up and things are a little out of order. But there's a guy known as the Pothole Robin Hood down in Jackson, Mississippi. And essentially this guy went out, stole some asphalt, presumably from the city of Jackson, and started filling potholes in, because the city wasn't doing it. They had the asphalt, but they weren't filling in the potholes. And so this guy went out, got the asphalt, and presumably stole it, started patching the potholes, and would spray paint on the ground that it was fixed by the citizens. Specifically, he would spray messages with "citizen fixed" to point out the fact that somebody had done the job and it wasn't the city. And, you know, when it comes down to it, these local governments, in my opinion, and I've made this clear on the show before, my opinion on local government is that local government does have a role to play in basic infrastructure. And part of that is the roads. The problem is I'm sure Jackson, Mississippi, like everywhere else, these cities have gotten themselves tangled in all these other messes and they've deviated away from their core premise of existing to begin with, which is the creation and upkeep of basic infrastructure. And so this guy's going out and doing it. Now, they're threatening to arrest him. They're threatening to do all this different stuff. It's pretty funny because he's committing two crimes, right? The first crime is he's doing a job that a union guy is supposed to be doing. And the second crime is that he's making the government look bad because he's out just doing it. And it's funny in a way, but also very telling of what the problems are with our governments today. Our local governments should be taking care of our local roads. That's ideally how this should work, at least in my mind. Local government having the most control over basic infrastructure and the levels up from there, basically protecting us from our local governments in case our local governments get abusive. The cities, though, are so mired in all these other ding-dong projects and not focusing on infrastructure that people get very, very frustrated. And, you know, it can be fixed. It's something that we can do, especially at the local level. At the local level, our voices are the absolute loudest that they are in politics. And I've talked about this on the show before. We have the ability at the local level to really make a difference, to really push the things that need to be done and push out the things that don't need to be done. You can run for city council. You can run for a county seat here in Kentucky. Oftentimes, many of the counties only have one city, but there's always a county fiscal court. That court may be made up of commissioners or of magistrates. Most of them are magistrates. Now, Lexington and Louisville, you're a little different. I know you're consolidated government, and it's a mess. And I don't even know what to tell you about that. It's a mess. But you should be looking to run for these local offices, because at the local level, we have the ability to focus government on what it's supposed to be doing. We have the ability to tell government, we don't want you to build the 17th park. We want you to patch the holes in the road. We don't want you to send money to some funding thing that's silly that's planting some trees somewhere. We want you to fix doors. These are the questions of government, the basic infrastructure. Those are the must-haves. If you don't have a basic infrastructure, you don't have a city. If you don't have roads, if you don't have sewers, if you don't have running water, you're not a city, man. That's all there is to it. You're not a city if you don't have those things. And so we have the ability to take control of these local governments. And I mean take control of them in the proper way, at the ballot box. I'm not talking about any craziness. I'm talking about doing it legitimately. Get control of our local government. It's not out of the question. It's not impossible to do. We absolutely can do it. We need to do it. And speaking of local control, I mean, that even goes up to the state level, right? I mean, especially libertarians, a lot of our folks like to focus on these federal races and federal offices and what the federal government's doing. But there are things that can be done at the state and local level. I got a story here that the governor of Alaska signed House Bill 69, which nullifies federal gun laws, NDAA indefinite detention, and the Real ID Act. That's pretty nice, right? I mean, you've basically told the feds, yeah, we're not doing that here. And we can do that here in Kentucky. Now, the problem with Kentucky, of course, is that for every dollar we send to D.C., we get $1.50 back. And so that puts us in the position of basically being owned by the federal government, because we can't take a 33% cut in our budget overnight. Right, I mean, that would be pretty devastating, just in general. You'd have a lot of social unrest if that were to occur. But what we can do is start looking at our local communities and working our way into state offices and getting people to understand that if we get involved, that if we decide we can take back our government, and if we can get control of this monster and get spending under control to the point where we're at a 1-to-1 ratio, or even better, we're getting less back than we send, which sounds bad, but it changes the nature of the relationship. Now all of a sudden we're not a slave to the government. The government gets more from us than we get from them. That means we're in control of the relationship now. We're wearing the pants, as my father would say, or has said in the past. We're wearing the pants in the relationship at that point. And the point being that we now have, at that point, we would have the ability to tell the feds, yeah, we're not doing that. Oh, you're going to cut off our funding? In Colorado a few years back, the feds were trying to force them to do something. I forget what it was. And Colorado said, we're not going to do it. And the feds said, oh, yeah, well, then we won't send you this grant money. You know, federal highway dollars is usually the one they use. Excuse me. I see. Sorry. Colorado had put forth a bill. Now, it didn't pass, but they put forth a bill that all federal taxes would be collected by the state and put into an escrow account. And then the escrow account would be at the discretion of the state whether or not to pay the feds. That's pretty bold. Pretty bold. But it also kind of draws a line in the sand and says, hey, you want to keep pushing this? We'll keep pushing it. Maybe you should back off. And in the scenario where you're not a slave state, when you're not a $1.50 back for every dollar you send, you have the ability to do that. You can push back and say, oh, you're going to take our money away? Well, we're just not going to send it to begin with. Now what? And if you're not relying on getting more back than you're sending, then that works. But that doesn't work for us. Not today. We can't. I've only got about 4 minutes left. Wow, only 4 minutes left. And I still didn't get through everything. But we'll have to hit a couple of these things next week. One of the things I did want to get to this week was that it was an article from June 20th. Again, like I said, folks, some of this has been building up, that the Democrats and Tea Party Republicans joined forces to try to block aid to the Syrian rebels. And it's a good example of where when we cut through the party politics and we cut through the partisanship and start focusing on philosophy, we can actually get some good things done. You know, I've had far too many people, especially with the Snowden thing, say, well, nobody complained about it when Bush was doing it. Why are you complaining about it now that Obama's doing it? Well, me personally, I've been complaining about it since Bush was doing it. I mean, I didn't, you know, suddenly come around only because Obama was president. Now, certainly, there are some of those people. And then there are other people that really didn't understand the scope of what was going on until recently. And, you know, you can't really blame them for that either, although I wish they would pay better attention. But the problem is the premise of that question. Well, you know, man, I was against it when Bush was against it, and you weren't, and now you're against it. Well, why are you against it? Is it just because it's Obama? Dude, it doesn't matter why. It doesn't matter why. We need to work together on those types of issues. Don't smack people around for coming late to the party. You say, I'm glad to have you on board. Let's get this done. Because it can actually get done. If we make the NSA spying issue a major issue in 2014, if we make it one of the campaign issues of 2014, we can actually get rid of it. We can do it. Absolutely. If liberty-minded people from the left and the right and the middle come together and we say, this is what we want, and there's a loud enough choir singing that, regardless of who the president is, then we can actually get it done. We can actually get that done. We can get rid of that program. We can scale them back at least. We can cut their funding. There's lots of things that can be done. But we have to work together when we agree and can't get divided on partisanship. That's not going to help anything. The lady of Blog Talk Radio just informed me I have 90 seconds left. So I just want to leave you with this. We can take our government back legitimately. I know people on the left, despite the fact that Obama's president, really aren't really happy with the way things have turned out. I know people on the right, when Bush was president, weren't really happy about how that turned out. We have the ability to take control. We have the ability to take our government back. But it requires us to not get caught up in the partisan bickering, but instead of working together when we agree. And we can get a lot of good stuff done. And there's going to be times when we disagree. That's okay. We're going to disagree sometimes because we're all individuals and we come from different backgrounds and everything else. But when we agree, let's just get it done. Let's do it. Let's work together. I mean, it's just that simple. Let's work together and get it done. Let's make this a big issue this year. Folks, it's the end of the show. We're out of time. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in next week for another edition of Liberty Unbridled. It'll be probably a one-hour show. And other than that, have a good week. Take care, folks.